If you're thinking about a book to read or CD to listen to after the show today, Victor Godinez has a suggestion. He's a technology reporter for the Dallas Morning News and recommends a website called Metacritic. That's MetaCritic.com. There you'll find reviews for almost every major new book, movie, game, and CD.
Think your local film reviewer is a studio suck-up who loves to see himself quoted on movie posters? Go to Metacritic.com to see how his comments compare to what his peers had to say. Are you tired of reading the same elitist claptrap about how Transformers doesn't hold a candle to that low-budget indie flick about the plight of Bulgarian cucumber farmers? Hello, Metacritic. The site compiles the reviews and review scores, be it a letter grade, percentage, or simple thumbs up or down, from around the country for almost every major book, movie, game, and CD that gets released every week. The grades are then averaged into a single Metascore, giving you a great sense of the general verdict from reviewers around the country. But along with the single Metascore, you can also see the individual scores from every reviewer, along with the first sentence or two of their review and a link to it. The site, which was launched in 2001 by three former attorneys, doesn't compile reviews from every single reviewer. Instead, Metacritic staffers pick reviews from the 30 or 40 critics they consider the best and most thoughtful in the country. That's usually enough samples to provide a wide range of opinions, although the best and worst games, movies, and so forth do tend to attract fairly uniform praise or scorn. Quirky, less well-known titles tend to garner the broadest commentary. They are also an interesting case study in how a cult film, for example, tends to be dismissed or overlooked on its original release. Take the Coen brothers' movie The Big Lebowski, a goofy musical comedy about a lazy, unemployed bowler in Los Angeles and his quest to deliver a ransom payment for a kidnapped trophy wife to a band of angry nihilists. The Metacritic score for this oddball masterpiece is a pedestrian 69 out of 100 from the professional reviewers. Many were baffled by the strange style and meandering plot. But glance over at the reader reviews, and the movie has an average score of 96 out of 100, reflecting its gradual migration into the cult hall of fame. Metacritic.com, now owned by CNET Networks, which runs a variety of technology-related websites, does have some drawbacks. The biggest is that most of the reviews only date back to the late 90s, so you can't really mine for forgotten gems from decades past. Still, Metacritic is both a great resource for anyone looking to get the biggest bang for their entertainment buck and a superb way to waste an afternoon.
Victor Godinez is a technology reporter for the Dallas Morning News. This is NPR News.
A secretary is not a toy, no, my boy, not a toy.
For nearly a century, Katharine Gibbs schools have produced clerical ones, secretaries, if you please, who are poised and accomplished professionals, and occasionally, forgive the expression, pert, like the fragile and touching Fran Kubelik, played by Shirley MacLaine, opposite Jack Lemmon in The Apartment.
Well, I came to New York and moved in with my sister and her husband. He drives a cab. And they sent me to secretarial school, and then I applied for a job at Consolidated, but I flunked the typing test.
Too slow?
No, I can type up a story. I just can't spell. So they gave me a pair of white gloves and stuck me in an elevator. And that's how I met Jeff. Oh, God, I'm so fouled up. What am I going to do now?
Good question. The days of white-gloved elevator operators, dulcet voices answering phones, and executives bidding, take a letter, are drawing to a close, outdated by phone mail, email, voice recognition software, and spell check. Which might explain why this week the Career Education Corporation, which owns the 9 Katharine Gibbs schools sprinkled through the East, announced it will close 7 of its campuses. They say the schools have become increasingly unprofitable. Unless they find a buyer, the 2 remaining campuses will close by the end of next year. Katharine Gibbs schools tried to change along with the workplace. They added programs in business, healthcare administration, and graphic design. And this year, half the students at the Boston campus are men. They've come a long way since the days of the long-suffering Miss Marmelstein of Broadway's I Can Get It For You Wholesale.
I'm a very willing secretary. Enjoy my work as my employer will corroborate.
excitement. It's great. I mean simply great. But the aggravation of my situation, I might as well get it off my chest, is the Trump appellation. Oh, pardon the big words I apply, but I was an English major at CCNY.
The Gibbs schools didn't teach just office skills. They were considered a kind of finishing school for workplace professionalism, encouraging students to be well-dressed and well-mannered. Which might sound just a bit antique in these times when casual Fridays seem to creep earlier into the week and people in cubicles can be overheard swearing like sailors at somebody's voicemail. Executives like to think they ran things, but the smartest of them always knew that the hand that took shorthand ruled the workplace.
A secretary is not a toy, and when you put her to use, observe. When you put her to use,
that you don't find the name Lionel on her caboose.
A secretary is not a thing wound by key, pulled by string. Her pad is to write in and not spend the night in. If that's what you plan to enjoy, no!
Take a letter, sweetheart. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
The secretary you got is definitely not employed to do a gavotte. Or you know what, before you jump for joy, remember this, my boy. A secretary is not.
Here at Morning Edition, we don't make the news, we just report it. So don't blame us for the return of a 1980s pop culture phenomenon.
La, 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 sing a happy song. La, 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 smurf the whole day long.
Smurfs are those little blue creatures that took America by storm and had many kids glued to their TVs on Saturday mornings. If you still pine for Smurfs, the original series will soon be out on DVD, and next year a 3D Smurf movie is coming out as well. From Brussels, Terry Schultz has more on the comeback.
Smurf along with me!
Even non-TV viewers couldn't escape their influence on youth culture, vocabulary, and joke-telling. The Smurfs took America by storm in the 80s with a cartoon series that won Emmys along with fans as the little blue imps laughed and played in their idyllic mushroom village, always a wee step ahead of the villainous Gargamel.
Stop all that happiness out here! I said stop it, stop it, stop it!
It did stop in the early 90s when the Smurfs' human guardians decided the American market was getting oversaturated, so they brought the Smurfs home to their Belgian birthplace. The Smurfs began life in a comic strip created by Pierre Culliford, a Belgian cartoonist, 50 years ago. So are they having a midlife crisis? Au contraire, they're planning a comeback.
Oh my gosh, it's a Smurfademic!
But can they succeed? Unlike their 80s-era forebears, kids these days can play virtual tennis and drive virtual race cars, even steal them, on their TVs. It's hard to imagine them being mesmerized by these cutesy little creatures endlessly repairing their mushroom houses or picking flowers in the forest. But that's not something that worries the man in charge of global marketing for the Smurfs, Hendrik Koisman.
People like simple things because we are living in such a complicated, confused world. It's so hectic. The Smurf Village can be a good place to rest for a couple of minutes or hours.
Reaction to the relaunch may already be proving him right. And children like these youngsters in Berlin do indeed seem to be impressed with the simple life of the creatures they know as Schlümpfe. The Smurfs build all sorts of things for themselves, bridges and things like that, says 8-year-old Harun Sariusten. My favorite Smurf always has a pencil over his ear. He writes stories, shares 9-year-old Marlene Hunger. But there have been detractors over the years. Some Americans felt the Smurfs' communal village depicted a communist utopia. Others just felt it was too sickeningly sweet. But the most frequent complaint has been about the male male-female ratio and gender roles. Papa Smurf makes all the big decisions, while Lovely Smurfette, the most prominent of just three females, does little more than run around in high heels. Hendrik Koisman says the Smurfs world is getting a birthday makeover, acknowledging it needed one.
If you look at our society, there has been a dramatic change in the social and cultural environment, so we are thinking in that direction.
Most details of the changes are still secret, except for the fact that Smurfette will finally be getting some female company. The Smurfs are also hoping to have an impact outside the Mushroom Village. They've teamed up with UNICEF to raise money and awareness to help other little beings whose lives in the real world aren't all so, well, Smurfy. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
You can see how the Smurfs have evolved over the decades by going to NPR.org.
Back now with Day to Day. There's a new wave in runway fashion. It's not about the clothes, though. It's about the coif. The artists aren't stylists. They are hair entertainers. Celeste Headley reports from the front lines of what's being called the hair wars.
There are at least 2,000 people packed into this hotel ballroom, with more trailing into the hallways and milling in the lobby. In the center of the room is a catwalk, and the models strut by while pounding hip-hop plays. But although the models are dressed elaborately, no one's really looking at what they're wearing. They're looking at their hair.
It's just something to see. I mean, because they go way out, you know, they really get into it and everything, and it's just exciting just to see the different things they can do with hair.
Maddie Watson drove several hours to see the Hair Wars spectacle, and like many of the other audience members, she doesn't work in the hair industry. She's just here to see the show. And what a show it is.
Please give him a hand.
Women with helicopters on their heads, propellers spinning. One woman balances a barbecue grill complete with spatulas and tongs. Another has hair that's been molded into flames of brilliant orange, gold, and red. Hair Wars producer David Humphrey says one model was actually carrying a live 4-foot python in her hair.
She said she was a little nervous. The thing was moving around, you know, it was in a separate compartment, but it wasn't her hair. It was a Nefertiti hairstyle, and he unzipped it and pulled out this snake. But the snake died, you know, all the traveling. He couldn't handle it.
Humphreys created Hair Wars about 20 years ago in Detroit, and it's grown since then into a national touring show. He says the stylists love the chance to break away from layered cuts and fades.
They use Hair Wars as a forum to really go crazy. And Hair Wars is a place for them to showcase it. That's the platform we have for them to really be the artists that they are.
Detroiter Big Bad D created a style with a fishbowl embedded in the model's hair, and inside were two Chinese fighting fish engaged in a turf war. The show lasts about 4 hours, with 250 models crossing the runway. Audience member Betty Paul says, although none of these styles would be seen on a street corner, people like to see what the trends are.
They want to see what's going on, what hairstyles out, what things is being done now.
And she says hair has no limits as a creative material.
You can make hats, you can make dresses, you can make coats, you can do all kind of things with hair.
Backstage at the Hair Wars, stylist Raphael has just arrived with his models. They're the picture of elegance, with black and white gowns and fantastically elaborate updos. One looks like a sparkling chandelier, another like a cascading fountain.
I always been into fantasy hairdos. I like to take the hair from basics all the way to fantasy.
Uh-huh.
So it's my dream. It's inside me.
Near Raphael is another stylist working feverishly, attaching sculpted pieces to a girl's head. Dang Toy Lewis says just one of these coiffures can take weeks to create and cost a considerable amount of money.
You get 4 minutes on stage, but you know what? Sometimes you get pictures. I saw myself in an international magazine. You know, just that 5 minutes of fame, it's worth that to me.
Back out in the ballroom, the audience applauds for a rainbow afro that's at least 3 feet wide.
Oh, beautiful.
Acclaimed artist Tyree Guyton is watching in amazement.
This has taken me to another level of what it can be, the possibilities, taking hair beyond what we think it should be.
Guyton is used to cutting-edge art. 20 years ago, he used found objects to transform abandoned houses in an inner-city Detroit neighborhood. The controversial installation piece became a flashpoint in the city and remains a tourist attraction on Heidelberg Street. His wife, Janine Whitfield, says they've been so inspired by the sculptural aspects of the hairstyles, they've decided to collaborate with the Hair Wars crew on an artistic event.
But the fashion has to be from found materials.
and then the hair will complement the fashions. And we're going to do a catwalk on Heidelberg Street in the ghetto. Won't that be hot?
And if the Hair Wars show is coming to your town, keep in mind that the stylists are always looking for models with good heads. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Headlee in Detroit.
Come on, you can do better than that. Give it up.
You know, there are radio stories that it really helps to see. And you can see this because photographer David Yellen has documented hair wars in a new book by the same name. You can see his photos of the crazy do's at npr.org.